Welcome to Foreman and Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And today it's all about green stuff. All those things that my daughters are terrified of. Herbs, lettuces, greens, beet tops. When you were a kid, now Cindy, and I've teased you about it before on the radio, you were fussy about certain food you wanted to eat, didn't want to eat. What was the number one green that you didn't want? Because in my house, like basil gets a yuck. Kale gets a, ooh, you know, it's no end of that sort of stuff. What was top of your list?
Of course, when I was a kid, those things weren't served fresh. So they wouldn't have appeared to be green. They would have been dried herbs. But I know a green vegetable that I didn't like, which was peas. I sat in front of many a cold bowl of peas that were, of course, frozen peas. I don't know if my mother ever had access to fresh peas, but I would have already been so mentally opposed to them that even if they were fresh, it wouldn't have made a difference to me. I still would have not wanted to eat them. But I think, you know, I know it just from my experience as a chef in a restaurant with children, it's often, please don't put anything green on the plate like parsley or anything exactly like that. And I totally understand. So, you know, and often things, you know, I think oftentimes parents just word it, could, you know, can things be plain? And I know what they mean. So yeah, it's funny how you feel about so many things when you're a child and as you grow and your palate changes and you become, you know, more, you know, you travel more, or you experience new things or meet new people from different cultures, whatever the case may be, that exposes you to things that perhaps you didn't have exposure to as a child, allows you to open your mind towards food.
I was not the fondest of all things green when I was a kid, but I wasn't bothered by it so much. But I tell you, the thing that really sort of stunned me, I was living and working in Philly, and every day I went to a market to get food to make this prefix lunch for this writer's club where I was the chef. And it was a small club, and it was you know, like 35 people for lunch, and fine. And they had this weird stuff. I was like, And so I smelled it. It was interesting, a little peppery. And then, so I bought some, and I took it back to the kitchen, and I washed it, and I picked it up, and I bit into it, and I was just like, oh my gosh. What is this? This is the whole different thing. This is like bitter and peppery and sharp.
What was it, Tony?
Arugula.
Arugula? Yeah. Oh,
arugula.
My gosh.
You know what I mean?
What an exciting first taste. I love arugula. Yeah, I mean, everybody loves arugula. Yeah.
The other weird thing at that time was radicchio, you know, which was super bitter.
And beautiful.
And beautiful. And I immediately liked that stuff. But man, oh man. And I recall like making a salad at my dad's house with those things at some point, not long after that. And he just was like, oh, yuck, which is complete circle with my 7-year-old's reaction to basil.
That's funny.
So let's go through our top 10 list of green leafy things and favorite things to do with them. Okay. What do you think?
Yeah. Can we start with Genovese basil? Because I'm so in love with that right now.
Of course. So what makes Genovese basil special?
It's a little bit heartier, the leaf, which is nice because it's not so, you know, the regular variety of basil is so tender.
It's often hydroponic.
Yeah, and it's mild, exactly, and it's milder. With the Genovese, it's just got a beautiful, pungent, gorgeous, sexy smell to it and tastes fantastic, and it's really wonderful to work with. And I'm getting it from Karma Farm here locally from John, who is just the most gifted farmer, really in love with his products. And we also got an heirloom variety eggplant from him yesterday that I have never seen before, and it's called Rosa Bianca. The eggplant is purple and white, and it has an unusual shape. It's sort of almost rounded with crinkly things in it. It's, and they're smaller. They're kind of like, if you put your two hands together, almost small, like almost the size of a regular cantaloupe. And we fried some last night for one of the dishes on the menu for our bison tenderloin, and put it on there with hoppenjohn and a great red wine reduction sauce. And oh my gosh, it was so, so, so good. So I'm thinking, you know, between the Genovese basil and that I would do a mayonnaise with the Genovese basil for this eggplant tonight. And that would be a great combination. Another way that I recently used the Genovese basil was when I cured a side of salmon. And when you cure it, you do a salt, sugar, pepper cure. I typically do about 24 hours. Some chefs press it down. I do not. Some chefs do for a longer period of time. I do not. I think 24 hours for the right size fish is absolutely the perfect amount of time. And I packed on probably a pound and a half of the Genovese basil stem on. I just sort of beat it up with a meat mallet and to get it going. And I place it on top of the cure on top of the salmon and wrap it in plastic nice and tight and put it in the walk-in. And oh my gosh, that permeated that salmon so beautifully without overwhelming it by any means. But it really, really brought on a beautiful tone to that cure. And just super happy with it. And we also made pesto with it, of course, when we first got it this summer. And it just makes brilliant pesto. So that we, you know, those are three ways that we will be using it. But there's, and it's on our tomato salad. Last night we put it on the grilled octopus dish with heirloom tomatoes and lime supremes and a really good Greek, pretty extra virgin olive oil. So just so much you can do with it.
So is endive a leafy green?
No.
What do you mean? It's a little green on the edges.
Oh, golly.
It's funny. You know me, I like bitter flavors.
Mm-hmm.
So that's on my list.
Okay.
And I feel like Belgian endive is totally unappreciated because it has that bitterness, you know.
We used that salad on at one of our restaurants for years and years with the walnuts and the Belgian endive and blue cheese. That salad was so good with the endive.
Well, that's the thing is if your dressing is a little bit sweet. And it's sour from the acid, mm-hmm. and you have the fat from the blue and the strength of that, and the bitter from the endive, you know, then you have a pretty complete palate there, you know, mm-hmm. you get all 5 points. But yeah, that's endive is definitely one of mine. And I cannot imagine if I'd eaten that as a kid.
Oh, no.
One of my all-time favorite cheddar hors d'oeuvres is to make almost any kind of mousse, or it could be like a very simple blue cheese mousse, like you mentioned, with little walnut crumbles or something, mm-hmm. and just pipe it. Use a piping bag and just pipe it onto endive, and that's very cute on a tray, very easy to pass, and
it's a fun hors d'oeuvre.
As a wintertime thing, you know, as it's available an awful lot of the time, why not?
Yeah. Well, and with Treviso, that shape, it's kind of fun to pair the Belgian endive with the Treviso because they're sort of similar in shape. That's
Treviso's same family as Ridicchio.
Yeah,
but it's spear shaped.
Mm-hmm. And if you introduce like arugula to that salad, give it the peppery taste, or a sweeter lettuce, you know, to give again balance. But that could be a pretty visual: the Belgian endive and the Treviso together.
Yeah, no question. So what? I feel like I copped out on the leafy green part, but we can get back to that. Mm-hmm. So what else is on your list of
well, my favorite
leafy greens and herbs?
If I had to come up with a favorite herb in this world, it would be lemon verbena. And when I had my farm, I used to grow like 20 plants, which would turn into a massive amount of verbena. Yeah. And it did very well there in that soil. And and of course I knew nothing about growing anything when I started the farm, and I learned that the more you cut it, the better it does, and really turns into like a bush. And it can live over the winter if you have the right environment for it. I have saved a couple of plants before, so that's another nice thing about it. But it's really not something you want to eat as it is. I make either
yeah,
a
it's
marinade.
Almost, it's almost furry, you know?
Yeah, it is. It's got a weird sort of, weird texture to the leaf. That's kind of undesirable. I really, my favorite thing is to make lemon verbena water with it, and or lemon verbena tea, whatever you want to call it. It's like lemonade made with lemon verbena. And I just bring the water up to a boil, and obviously you wash the leaves, and I take them off the stem, and just drop them in the water after it boils. I turn it off and drop them in and let it steep for like 2 minutes. You don't want to leave it in there too long. It'll actually become a little bit bitter and weird. Take it out, strain it, and I actually add fresh lime juice and sugar to it. And it's just one of the most refreshing drinks ever. It's so refreshing when you when you're making it. The smell, the you know smell that goes into the air. It's just it's like an amazing, beautiful thing. You can also make a vinaigrette with it, because if you're pureeing it in a blender, you lose that weirdness in the texture. You can make a marinade for fish. For pork. But I think it's really great for fish. You know, you always kind of want that lemon citrusy tone with fish, and lemon verbena is very good with that. You used to make a crab and lemon verbena salad, which I always love so much. So a vinaigrette with crab meat.
That crab and corn salad.
Yeah, that salad was spectacular. You know, it was nice to have the layer of corn and then the layer of crab, and that vinaigrette, that lemon verbena vinaigrette was really, really good. So that's one of my favorite herbs, and I strongly suggest growing it. It's hard to find.
Well, it's not tough to grow either.
No, it's easy to grow, but it's hard to find. It's. You know, I mean, I've never seen it in a grocery store ever. So, you know, I get it from myself. We do have some farmers that grow it now, which is great.
Cindy's Yard Farm.
Mm-hmm. That's what it is. It's worked out pretty well.
The thing that I love that's the devil to get is sorrel.
Yes.
So much.
I love sorrel. It's beautiful.
There's an old French country soup that is a potato and sorrel soup. It's potatoes in water with any kind of like ham knuckle, ham broth, like just literally, it's not a brown bone or something like that. It's literally something to give a little bit of body to it. Mm-hmm. And the starch from the potato is what thickens it. When you get towards the end of cooking, you add the sorrel, add a little bit of cream, cook it for a few minutes, and then just puree it and through a sieve, and the potato starch does all the work.
Mm-hmm.
Sorrel has a sort of a citrusy flavor also, but not perfumey like verbena. It's much more like lemon oil, let's say.
Yeah, it's earthy. It's more earthy.
Yeah.
It's more of the earth. I mean, you really feel like if you didn't know what lemon verbena, if you had that, you would think it was a citrus fruit. You would never think that was an herb, quite frankly. But with sorrel, you know it's an herb. You know it's from the earth that way, you know. And with that soup, I would, you know, if I were making it, I would do a little onion shallot sautéed in butter and then add the potatoes, add the water or light chicken stock, a white chicken stock. And as you say, the potatoes and the cream, I would skip the ham bone. I would add the onion product and add that sorrel at the very end and a good amount of it and make sure it's washed really, really well. Cause that's some dirty stuff. And I also make just a straight cream with sorrel for salmon, you know, in the traditional French way, which is very light and can be very pretty. If you bring the cream up to a boil, add a little salt and pepper. You could add a little stock, but I wouldn't. I wouldn't say you had to, I guess I should say. And then put the cream in the blender, obviously being very, very careful because it's hot liquid, and adding a whole bunch of sorrel and pureeing and straining again. And that's just such a gorgeous sauce for salmon. And then you could use your potato in the form of a potato puree and have potato puree on the plate. Mm, I could eat that right now.
It's funny. The soup that I mentioned is just like the simplest, like, you know, mm-hmm. country grandma recipe. That the sorrel sauce, the other version that I know is the Trogro version, where they sweat the shallots for so long, reduce the cream, and then at the very end of cooking they just add a huge amount of full leaf fresh sorrel, and all you see when you see that dish is a huge plate full of that sauce.
Mm-hmm.
And the pan-seared salmon sitting on it, and no decoration, no nothing. It is one of the perfect foods.
Mm-hmm. Maybe I'll try to grow sorrel next year.
I think you should grow sorrel next year.
Okay, I will. That sounds good.
When we come back on Formula Wolf on Food and Wine, we're going to eat our vegetables and herbs and greens on WIPR. Welcome back to Foreman and Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And we're talking greens and herbs, green veggies. Eat your veggies, Cindy.
Yes. I love vegetables.
Should we dig right into cilantro?
Sure.
I mean, I love it so much.
Me too. But I didn't used to.
You didn't used to.
Exactly.
You didn't used to. How did you convert to the cilantro side of things?
I had food that had great cilantro preparations and just realized how important it was to the dish and how perfect it was. And, you know, I think just the smell of cilantro is a little bit off-putting for some people. And, I mean, I have a guest that whenever he dines, I know I'm doing the ceviche no cilantro for him. So I'm just glad I know it. Because it's time consuming to make the marinade, and we know we can make a little extra without, and I totally understand. I mean, my sister hates cilantro. I know a lot of people that just can't stand it, and it's not like anything else. And I know people will say it's almost soapy, and you know, it's not that it's soapy, it's just that it's really different. And it's so important to so many cultures cooking, you know, you know, if you have a really great salsa verde, I think you're going to find that you love cilantro. If you have guacamole, you have to have cilantro in there. I mean, you know, it's an important ingredient, guacamole. And there are ways to get people to like cilantro, I think. Or not. Maybe they'll just never like it, but I love it now.
We had a nutritionist a couple years ago on the program who talked about how she ate like just bunches and bunches of cilantro because it was so healthful. Huh. And I thought, well, that's kind of wacky. I mean, I like cilantro a lot. But I've found myself over time, especially when the cilantro is really fresh and really good, like make quesadillas for the girls. And then the one for myself, it just gets a giant amount of, you know, cilantro dressed with a little bit of lime juice and a little tiny bit of oil and just covering the entire thing. Would you do that?
No.
Oh.
Well, yeah. I mean, I like it in moderation. That's all there is to it.
I'm in that group of I love piles of it now.
All right. Well,
and,
good.
And in combination with other herbs sometimes too, cilantro and basil I like very much together, especially for certain fish.
The guys made a salsa last night that had a little level of spice to it, and it was all jalapeno that they put in because I'm growing Tabasco peppers in my garden, and I thought perhaps I had brought some in because they just started to turn red, and I said, oh gosh, did you use some of the, because it was really spicy. It was delicious, and no, chef, just jalapeno, and just absolutely brilliant. Some of our more ripe tomatoes and onion and cilantro and the jalapeno and salt and lime and, you know, a little water. Just absolutely delicious. So cilantro, you know, how do you like to use it besides a salsa verde or, you know, something that we all recognize, like you said, the burrito? What else have you done with it? Or what's something unusual you might have done with it?
Well, I said quesadilla because you can pile it on top of it. Mm-hmm. Almost like a salad or a garnish, you know? Yeah, I mean, honestly, just something as simple as doing proper scrambled eggs, you know, and I think you and I like kind of the same sort of thing where it's like slightly underdone and very soft and pillowy and what my daughters call fluffy eggs. Mm-hmm. And that with just a little bit of hot sauce and a big old pile of fresh chopped cilantro, like releasing the oil, that's great. I've also put cilantro on like a, you know, I'm a lamb sandwich guy, right? Mm-hmm. That with any kind of little pickled something and a lot of cilantro is great. I don't know. I like that. I like that dominant cilantro thing.
Not to deviate, but I'm going to deviate. So you just mentioned scrambled eggs, and I think we should just briefly mention that, you know, what you're referring to is really shaking the pan and breaking up the curd of the egg into fine pieces. And you do that with a fork and the action of moving the pan vigorously while you're cooking them. And my mother was a very good cook, and no one ever told her to do something like that. I mean, this is very French in approach. I mean, the French people would do it in a bowl over a pot with hot water in the bottom, and it takes a while to do an egg scrambled that way. So I don't do it that way for myself, but I at home, I do it in a small saute pan that's a good quality pan. I melt butter in, and I melt a decent amount of butter in. You don't want to be dry on that pan. And you get that hot, then you crank it all the way back down. And you, because it starts the egg, and then you can make it work, and you know, shake the pan, move it as much as possible, keep the heat on low, and break up that curd, and it makes a really gorgeous scrambled egg. And take it off the heat, you know, just before it's done, so it's not dry. You want it to be a tiny bit. I'm not saying runny and gross, but you know, a tiny bit of underdone, so that it's still moist. You don't want it to dry.
You want it tender,
completely. Yeah, tender. And as you said, fluffy. It's actually fluffy. I made them the other morning, and I'm like, oh my gosh, this might be the best ones I've ever made. They were just absolutely perfect. And it's an art. You have to do it over and over and over again and practice to get it to be really, really perfect.
I think my daughter's a little bit like the princess and the pea with scrambled eggs. If I make them and they're exactly right, they crush them. Mm-hmm. They'll eat a couple of eggs in a second. If I'm not paying perfect attention, or if just about anybody else is cooking them, nope.
Yeah.
You know, Cindy, the other herb I like to do kind of the same thing, but no hot sauce with eggs, is tarragon. It is incredible how the egg will set off that particular little pungent anise, you know, character of the tarragon. It's a
tarragon's that, such that a beautiful a, herb. I don't use it often enough.
Yeah, that and a little Parmigiano.
Yeah,
great. Oof. Great on, right? On an egg.
That sounds super good.
Yeah, that's it. Was regular breakfast at a little locanda. I stayed in the Valtellina a couple of times on wine tasting trips. Italians call tarragon dragoncello.
Wow.
the most dramatic of herb names.
Awesome name.
So what? Here's a question for you. So herbs, we're talking about lots of tender herbs. What about things that are heartier, like sage, rosemary, lavender? I think people, or even thyme, people don't always know how to deal with those, I think.
The first thing that comes to my mind is in moderation. That's the first thing you need to think, because all of those will blow your head off and ruin a dish if you use too much of it. And okay, so I'll use risotto as an example. When I make my saffron risotto, I always put a stem of rosemary in, and I actually put it in with the butter in the very beginning. So I let it gently, not on high heat, very gently, melt that butter on low heat with that stem of rosemary in there. It begins to perfume that butter. And then I leave it in for the first batch of liquid. And then I remove the rosemary because it's done. It's completely done by then.
We've already taken all the oil.
Yep. You've taken everything out. It's done its job. It's starting to turn, you know, army green, and its leaves, little leaves are going to fall off, and you're going to have to pull those out of your risotto because nobody wants to eat a rosemary leaf. So, you know, that's a very good example, and hopefully something you can remember and comprehend as to how you really use an herb like that. With any fresh herb, you typically add it near the end of the cooking process, but not always. For example, let's say you were going to saute mushrooms, and we often will add a stem of rosemary to those. We put those in the beginning, and then we pull it out. If I was going to do the same thing with a piece of fresh thyme, and again, all of these herbs are so strongly flavored that you only need like maybe two stems of thyme or one stem of thyme, depending on how big it is and how much you're cooking. But yeah, fresh thyme and mushrooms is beautiful. Fresh rosemary and mushrooms, beautiful if you don't do too much and overwhelm it. Sage, I almost never use sage except to fry it. I think it's a beautiful thing when it's fried. I think it's fun to eat when it's fried. But sage,
I'd love sage.
I know. I'm not saying I don't like it. I just find that I rarely use it, and I'm growing some. I'm growing purple sage and green sage, and we often use it as a garnish because it's so beautiful. So I would use it with birds, with game birds. I would use it with a certain type of fish. I can see chopping it fine and adding it to a little bit of oil and rubbing it on a fish and grilling that fish. I think sage is absolutely gorgeous. Sage stuffing. Yes.
Let me open up the world of happiness with sage for you.
Oh, okay. Here we go.
So really beautiful egg pasta, right? Could be filled pasta, like a calzunce, or it could be tagliatelle or tagliolini, whatever it might be, but a beautiful egg pasta. All you need for that pasta, make brown butter, mm-hmm. add sage just as it's browning, mm-hmm. and releases all that oil almost immediately. Add Reggiano to that brown butter off the fire. Toss it all, and then pasta goes in, toss. That's where happiness is.
And if that pasta happens to be a pumpkin-filled tortellini, you're in heaven.
There's more stuff than that.
Yep. That's.
Oh, those tortelli. Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Up there near Chernobyl. Up by Lake Como, yeah. Oh, yeah. Lake Como in Italy. Yeah, that place. I hope someday I get to eat there again before I die. And they better have that pasta on the menu. That's one of the best things I've ever eaten in my life. And I will never, ever, ever forget eating it. And I've eaten it more than once there. I'm lucky.
Oh, yeah.
A lucky girl.
A little restaurant at Chernobyl, Il Vapore.
Oh. Gosh. No. And they have outdoor seating. It's really tiny. And they have outdoor seating. If that place is still open, go there immediately on your next vacation to Italy.
When you make your way to Chernobyl.
Oh, Lake Como is one of the most beautiful places ever.
It is. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I'm glad I could remind you how beautiful sage could be. So what else is on your list?
Well, we started to talk about, I mentioned that I got fennel in. I think we should finish that.
Is that actually an herb?
It is fennel is a perennial herb, apparently. Interesting. Oh, so the top
it just
of
doesn't
the fennel,
feel that herby.
The top of the fennel is huge. It gives you a ton of beauty. And I like to garnish with it certain dishes. And also, golly, if you make a soup, you know that same soup you were talking about with the sorrel?
Yeah.
With the potato, oh my gosh, you could just forget the sorrel and put the fennel tops in there and you would have a gorgeous, gorgeous soup. Fennel is so fine. You could just, add that at the very, very last moment in the blender and puree it and you'll have a gorgeous color and gorgeous perfume. But a fennel cream is also delicious for a piece of fish, especially a piece of salmon. But probably any white, sweet, flaky fish would be great with fennel cream. I do like to make fennel soup, but with the fennel bulb, what we're going to do is we will immerse them and we will salt them lightly and immerse them in butter. And
I'm shocked.
Slowly cook them. It's confiture, of the fennel in a 225 degree oven. It takes a long time. We also got badger flame beets in yesterday, so we'll be roasting those. And I'm going to pair the badger flame beets with the baby fennel and do that for the Wild King salmon tonight. That's going to be so good.
What are you
going to
do with the greens? What are you going to do with the greens?
That's from the beets.
Beet greens, turnip greens are on my list. So I'm going to jump ahead.
Okay. All right. I'm not going to do a damn thing with those, Tony. So you can
have them. Oh, I can have them. That's great.
Actually, there aren't any, there are very few tops on these beets that I got. So, but they're so beautiful. And I know you like to work with them. So what do you like to do with them?
Again, it's an Italian thought process. Thinking mm-hmm. fricassea, you have that little bit of pork shank that's left. You have a little bit of veal neck. You have a little bit of some meat that you want to that is already cooked through, very flavorful. That you go ahead and caramelize with a little bit of some kind of onion product. Could be a little garlic, shallot. Could just be a little sweet white onion, and get that going and crispy. And then wilt the greens in there,
mm-hmm.
That with pasta, the fricassee is a garnish for risotto, or it's served with other vegetables, is a super meal. And also one of the most elegant ways to use a leftover or something.
Yeah, that sounds so good. Yeah, well, you know, and it's such a strong flavor. It needs a strong meat like that. So that's perfect.
Yeah, exactly. That's amazing. Exactly.
Yeah, I'm excited. Everado makes a braised pork dish that's traditional to Mexico from pork shoulder. And if there are any greens left, maybe we'll add some of those to that dish at the end tonight. We're going to serve it with some really great rice and some of those that fried eggplant.
Yeah, to some extent. I mean, things like that or Swiss chard or Tuscan kale, you'd use them all pretty much in the same way. This is not the super curly, hearty, crazy kale that needs giant cooking. That's kind of like triple fibrous. That's a different thing, and it takes a lot of breaking down.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, well, I feel like we did something both of our mothers would have appreciated, which is talk about green leafy things for a little while. When we come back on Formidable Fun Food and Wine, Cindy, you got some like common wine questions for me, don't you?
I do. I have some good ones, Tony.
Make them hard.
All right. I'll work on it.
All right. When we come back on Formidable Fun Food and Wine on WIPR. Welcome back to Foreman and Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
We spent our last little bit talking about green vegetables, herbs, incorporating all those things in cooking,
right.
What to do with them, at least a few highlights, a few favorites. And you wanted to hit me with some wine questions.
Right. Well, do you think all those, we were just talking about herbs, do you think that herbs in food drive the choice of the wine?
I guess it really kind of depends upon how dominant something is, and you have to think about what are the flavors that are present to name a particular herb.
Rosemary.
So rosemary, if it's really strong flavor in something, it's always the specifics of the dish. Is it leg of lamb with rosemary? And what are you going to do with that? Well, you're going to need something that has body and structure and enough intensity to carry off the lamb and the lamb fat, right?
Yeah.
So the stronger seasoning for the lamb from the rosemary is not going to be problematic for most of the wines that are going to be in that direction. The things that come to mind immediately that sort of associate pleasantly with rosemary are things like the grape from the south of Italy, Aglianico, which almost has some of that tone to it. Bordeaux grapes. I'm a particular fan of Châteauneuf du Pape and some of the Côte d'Or Village wines, the Grenache Mourvèdre-driven things that have a lot of those dried herb aromas that come from the south of France. And also the grape Tempranillo from Spain, but in its bigger, denser forms, like from the Ribera del Duero, and the ones with more power, that carries something like leg of lamb with the rosemary really nicely, if that makes sense.
Sure.
If it's if it's delicate, mm-hmm. if it's, you know, a tono crudo, you know, a bluefin tuna with Genovese basil and a oil and a little bit of garlic or something, then you want something that's more delicate.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's just like a pigato from Liguria or something that you want with that.
Okay.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, definitely. What about for people that, you know, they just want to have a Cabernet Sauvignon tonight and, you know, people are, you know, because we are so into pairing and people know about it now. And then they may feel like, oh my gosh, you know, does that mean I have to have a piece of red meat? You know, I really want to eat fish, but yet I want Cabernet Sauvignon. How is that going to work for guests or people at home?
I think it's funny. I don't want people to feel like, oh, if I'm drinking what I want to drink, I'm doing the wrong thing, mm-hmm. you know, or, and I'll have guests act like, oh, this is what I want, but I don't want to order from you because you're going to judge me. And like, I'm not going to judge you. That's the fact that you're drinking wine is great. You're going to be happy about it and it's going to aid your digestion, you know, that's,
sure.
And you're going to like the food better.
You just want them to be happy. So
all of those are good things. Yeah. In the end, it's also your taste.
Right.
Do I think that there are things that will make each other more attractive? As an example, if let's say that you're shopping for clothes, you pick out your favorite necktie. Maybe not you, Cindy, but you pick out your favorite necktie and, uh-huh. and you pick out your favorite shirt. Mm-hmm. Are they necessarily going to look nice together? Maybe not, you know?
Right.
But if you're picking out one in context to the other, they may look nicer together. That's what pairing is really, that's what that's about. Something you may not notice so much on its own is stunning with something else. You know,
right.
That's where the magic is in those kinds of things. They grow in their association. So if you wanted to drink Cabernet Sauvignon with fish, it's like I can figure out how to get that done via fish preparation and via the Cabernet-based wine choice. But I think there's an invitation available to try things that you do not know that might be excellent. I mean, I do think that having someone that may know more than you know help you with that kind of thing is not a bad idea.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I certainly don't do my own taxes, you know. That's someone who is
well,
quite
no,
expert
I mean,
in that
it's
does
just,
that.
It's just easier when there's someone, you know, to help you. I mean, I certainly want that. I know some things about wine, but I, you know, there's so much to know. And it's always wonderful when someone has knowledge of the cellar and can make it easier for you. Why not?
It's also understanding people, and it's not just a textbook kind of thing. For example, talking to a lot of guests, we have wine lists in restaurants that are only French or only Italian. And a lot of times people, they're very accustomed to varietally named West Coast wines because that's a lot of what is available in a lot of retail stores and a lot of what is around.
Mm-hmm.
And so guests will come and say, well, I like a cab. And the reality is that they probably want the big body, the generosity, the, you know, that voluptuousness that comes with those wines. It's not the varietal necessarily that drives that. It's Bordeaux grape, but it because Cabernet Sauvignon is going to be different in Bordeaux than it is in the Napa Valley. Or
sure.
in Santa Cruz Mountains, or in Chile, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So the question is, what are the qualities that are given by what grapes in what place? Often for West Coast, you know, habituals, I'll recommend really ripe Merlot-based Bordeaux from Pomerol, Saint-Emilion, the Côte de Castillon, that are bigger, broader, more easily ripened there. That have that more generous texture, the acid's a little bit lower, the tannins are a little bit easier
mm-hmm.
than that is not the austerity that comes with Cabernet Sauvignon grown in Bordeaux and some of the other villages. So, it does not equate to Merlot on the West Coast, which is a same grape but adapted differently, grown in very different conditions. Does that make sense?
Yes, absolutely. You know, I think one of the other things, Tony, that's so intimidating about wine is knowing what is a good vintage. I mean, if you're in a place where you're not sure completely about the cellar or you're not sure about your choice, you know, you want to, like you say, maybe I want a Chardonnay to pop, but I'm not sure, you know, which vintage is really the best for that region. And, you know, it's just daunting. So how can you kind of... Is there a way to know what is a good vintage or a bad vintage?
I mean, it's relatively easy to research, and a good vintage is different for different outcomes. You know, if you're the grower, a good vintage is a vintage that's generous, that has a lot of production because you have more wine to sell.
Sure.
A good vintage for someone that keeps a cellar and wants to age the wines are vintages that are going to have the structural integrity and the you know, dense polyphenols and fruit to age a long time. A good vintage in a restaurant application, something that's available for purchase for that restaurant that is going to be attractive with a particular style of cooking, that's a different thing again. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So, I mean, good vintage in the mind of a wine writer X, they're vintages that have different purposes. So I don't think that you can just say, well, this is A plus, this is C, this is B plus, this is, I don't know that it's as pure as that. I do know, for example, 15, 16, both considered really strong vintages in Chateauneuf du Pape you mentioned.
Okay.
Right? Mm-hmm. 14 Chateauneuf du Pape, a little bit like the six a decade before, not as famous, not as well considered as the seven. In both cases, for restaurants, it was very useful, the sixes and the 14, because they're a little less tannic. They're more generous as young wines. Huh. They're a little more nuanced as young wines.
Okay.
So they offered a lot of generosity and complexity early.
They're drinkable.
Because, so there's a certain amount of, like, you buy the 14s to drink them while you wait for the 15s and 16s to actually mature
to
a little
grow
bit.
Up.
Or, exactly. Yeah. Or the 14 is the one that as it matures, maybe you have that with your grilled tuna, whereas the 16, you're going to have that with your lamb shank.
Got it. That's cool.
You know, that an excellent producer is probably going to make excellent wine in whatever the situation is, unless it's just an utter disaster.
Right. Like that 1 year in Chateauneuf du Pape when Parker was there and the torrential rain.
The crazy flooding.
Yeah.
He got his car stuck at
was that 02?
Laurent Charbon. Yeah, it was 02.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, they had the great run of vintages, 98 through 2001. Mm-hmm. And then 02 was Noah's Ark.
Gosh. Yeah. Impossible to make a good wine under those conditions.
One thing that in at least. It's funny that happens in a lot of Western Europe. 15 through 20 are all pretty darn strong vintages in a lot of places.
It's good,
which
to know.
Is nice.
Yeah, makes it easier.
And Europe is a lot more variable as far as vintage quality. South America is more variable as well than the West Coast. The further north you go on the West Coast, the more variable it is. Oregon, in particular. Can run up and down. I mean, Pinot is very sensitive to it, and that is the leading red grape in Oregon. So you have very different characteristics on different vintages. I don't know if that helps.
Sure. Another question, you know, so where in the world right now are good places to buy wine for your cellar, for your home?
Oh, I mean, in context of pure quality, in context of like what is the next big thing, or in context
bang
for the buck?
I like the next big thing.
The next big thing, I'm a very big believer in, lots of things and a lot of the classical things, but two areas in particular. One, in the south of France, the Languedoc. I think that there are a couple of excellent growers, and more and more and more are coming on board. They're exploring a lot better terroirs and a lot more individual micro situations for remarkable wines, especially red wines, mm-hmm. down there. I think that is coming on strong. I think in Italy, Umbria is kind of sleeping. And there's a huge amount of potential quality there. And there are a few growers like Paolo Bea, BEA, who make really high quality, super interesting stuff. For whites, I would say Galicia, for sure. Washington State for all kinds of things. Just a variety pack of grapes that they're trying out in eastern Washington. There's really interesting Tempranillo. There's really interesting Grenache. There's excellent Merlot. There's excellent Syrah. So those are things to pay attention to. But sort of number one on my list is I want to get to Chile. I've had some really, really high quality things from small producers recently in Chile that I want to go and find out more about exactly what they're doing. Because what I've tasted is really reflective of remarkable terroir. Wow. And just from paying close attention to it at with the altitudes and conditions that they have and the weather conditions, there's opportunity to make really remarkable age-worthy things. And having had some older things like the 1970 Conquistoro, you know, 50-year-old Cabernet Sauvignon that was probably like a dollar in a store when it was released, that was very much intact. Wow. That retained color was sort of shocking. I'm like, okay, if this wine, when made in relatively primitive conditions, can age a good bit like Bordeaux, then there's an awful lot of different possibilities here.
That's exciting. Well, and it would also be fun to eat the food on that trip. Love to go there and eat their food.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So let's just quickly talk about serving conditions. What is the proper temperature to serve red, white, champagne, you know, rosé?
If everything is 55, you're going to be okay, first off. If you're just bringing wine home from the store, put the red in the fridge for 20 minutes before you serve it, maybe 30, to get it a little cooler in the room temp. It's going to make a difference aromatically for sure in how you perceive the fruit. With the white, if you've had it in the fridge, take it out for 20 minutes to take some of that chill off, so it doesn't really denude the aromatics and the flavors that are there.
Okay.
Sparkling wine, sweet wine, really light white wine, rosé, things that are meant to be just crisp and refreshing, you want them cold. You want them on ice. You want them, you know, 40 degrees or lower as your refrigerator might be.
Okay.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, that's good.
And glassware that's been in the cabinet, if I have a bugaboo, glassware that's been in the cabinet smells like the cabinet, especially if it's a decent wine glass. For goodness sake, have them out. Make sure they get air and or wash them again so that the wine smells like the wine and not your cabinet.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point. Even
by the wine to smell your cabinet.
Right. Very good point.
So I think that's probably all we have time for. If you want to listen to this episode of Formula Wolf on Food and Wine or any one of the other podcasts, go to the WIPR website, wipr.org. Look for the Foreman Wolf page, and there'll be a big menu of programs that are there. If you want to follow Chef Cindy Wolf on social media,
you can follow me on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook as Chef Cindy Wolf.
You can correspond with us via email, foremanwolf@wipr.org. And my Instagram is TheRealTonyForeman. And thanks for listening.
Happy Sunday.